Okay, I'm going to pause and then start.
Okay.
Good morning and welcome to Talking About California. This is the second in our series of discussions about California and Californians who talk about themselves, their lives, and their work here. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. This morning, we're going local, very local, and lucky indeed to be able to do so. Our guest is David Samus, a longtime resident of the coast who's currently engaged, he tells me, in mushroom farming just down the road from here. David's hometown was Chicago, I think. He came to California as a young man to study at Modesto Junior College. There, the Selective Service selected him, and we'll get right to that. We'll be a bit pressed for time this morning. It's pledge drive time, as listeners know. We hope everyone will be generous, but good morning, David.
Good morning, Cal.
Great to have you here.
Well, thank you.
David, I was in college, too, in 1966, just getting my feet wet in anti-war work, but I remember the Fort Hood 3 vividly. Three young active-duty GIs who refused to ship out to Vietnam. Movement war heroes, to say the least. Pete Seeger, I think, wrote a song about you, The Ballad of the Fort Hood Three. And you were one of them. You were one of the Fort Hood Three. So let's start with that, David. And just a word about your background. Where did you come from? How did you get to Modesto?
Okay. Actually, I moved to California when I was in the fifth grade.
Okay.
So I was a youngster, but that was to Bakersfield, and I graduated from high school in Modesto, but I only went there for maybe like 4 months, 3 or 4 months. I moved there late in my senior year, and so I really wasn't a resident of Modesto. When I got out of school, I hit the road. I just started hitchhiking around the country, and my father had always said, I kind of grew up with him saying, when you're 18, you're out of here. You join the Army, get married, go to college, do whatever you want to do. And I was sort of grew up on my own a little bit. And so when I was 18, I just left home. I put my thumb out and started hitchhiking around the country. And at a certain point, after 5 or 6 months, I got word from home that I had gotten a draft notice. And I went back home and got in school and got a deferment. But after about...
So a deferment back in the 1960s meant what?
My draft number must have changed or something. They put off the draft. They put me off. They gave me an opportunity to go to school. But I dropped my Spanish class, and I didn't have enough credits. I didn't realize that that I was hanging on that thin a line. So anyway, when I dropped my Spanish class, I got drafted. I got a greetings letter in the mail, which is, you know, kind of stunning. And I didn't have any... I wasn't really politically aware. I was socially aware. I wasn't aware of how far left I was leaning in that regard. So I didn't have any support. I wasn't a conscientious objector. I do believe in the military and an army. I believe in defending oneself. So I went along with the draft. I went into the army.
You were inducted here in California?
Yes, I was inducted in Modesto, California. I had been in junior college like 3 or 4 weeks, thought I was safe, I was working, and then I got drafted. So they took me to Fort Ord, and then...
Where is that?
In the Bay Area there.
Yeah.
Outside San Francisco. And then from Fort Ord, I was in reception for a long time because I had gotten a little bit of trouble in reception. When I was drafted, there were 60,000 people drafted that month. And there was just a whole lot of us. And I kind of considered like we were the expendable ones. They were rounding up everybody. All the youngsters in America who you know, weren't nailed down or weren't involved in something else, and they picked us up. So there was a lot of people like me who were wondering what the hell happened and were questioning what was going on. But in our training, I was sent to Fort Hood, Texas, for basic training. And they were overwhelmed. The training staff was overwhelmed by the draft as well. And they weren't really that prepared for us. So there was a lot of us that just kind of, there was a certain amount of freedom we had that they didn't have later when they got better control over the training. And there was really no indoctrination of any kind as far as political indoctrination. No one ever mentioned Vietnam. They didn't answer questions. I was very vocal and always asking questions about what they were trying to do to us, why they were training me, and where I was supposed to go. And they really preferred not to let us know anything about Vietnam. It was better to keep us in the dark. And they'd tell us things like, well, you don't know you're going to Vietnam. Some of you are going to Germany, some of you will go, you know, here, there, and some will be staying in the States. But, you know, 99% of us were going to go to Vietnam. And we knew that. And probably the first time that I got any attention in my direction from the Army was at a... I don't know what they would call it. Anyway, there was a meeting of the... I was in the 1st Cav, 2nd Armored Division, and there was a 1st Cavalry meeting in the auditorium where they... It was an attempt at indoctrination, but it wasn't about Vietnam. It was just about instilling pride in our 1st Cavalry accomplishments over the, you know, since we fought the Indians. And at any rate, they had an assembly and a whole bunch of generals on the stage telling us what a wonderful unit we belonged to and how, you know, we had done so many great things in battles. And there was 186 battle flags on the stage, and they're talking about all these wonderful battles that the 1st Cav had won. And so the question came to me, well, what about the battles we had lost? And I thought, just as I'm a kid of average intelligence, I thought it was worth knowing things that the Army may have done wrong. And I knew the question wouldn't be popular, but I stood up and said, you know, I have a question, sir. I wonder if you could tell us anything about the battles that the 1st Cav has lost, because I'd be interested in knowing. And that was not a popular thing to ask. I was dressed down in front of, you know, 1,200 other soldiers. Probably 3 or 4 different officers told me off and, you know, tried to put me in my place. But I held my grounds and thought I had the right to know. But anyway, that got me some unwanted attention. And then I guess I kept it up. I'm the kind of guy who sort of throws himself into things. And if there's a question in my mind, it's going to come out of my mouth. So from Fort Hood, after basic training, I was sent to Fort Gordon, Georgia, for training in the Signal Corps. And while at Fort Gordon, we had more time there because the basic training is pretty rigorous. You're pretty busy all day long. But in Fort Gordon, Georgia, we had more time to talk to each other. Soldiers kind of, you know, were making friendships and stuff. And I got to know other people like me who were questioning what was going on, what was happening with us, why they were sending us to Vietnam, what the war was all about. And it's all these draftees, you know, were having to come to grips with what they were being asked to do. So people were talking about what it would feel like to kill somebody. There's people, young people, who want to be in the war. They want to see what it feels like to kill somebody. They wanted to see what combat was like. There was all sorts of romantic notions about how things are. And one of the big driving forces, though, behind all of it was the power of the Army to send you to Leavenworth. And everybody had heard Leavenworth thrown around by all the training people. You know, it was like the root of it. If you didn't like what was going on, you could go to Leavenworth.
And that's the federal penitentiary.
Yeah, that's the penitentiary. Leavenworth Military Prison and Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary are about a mile apart.
Hmm.
the Leavenworth Military Prison is dates from the Civil War. Beautiful, you know, it was a beautiful building. But at any rate, in Fort Gordon, Georgia, soldiers who had similar ideas started hanging out together, and we organized meetings behind the movie theater on the base at Fort Gordon. And there'd be 15 to 20 guys showing up to these meetings. And we were asking, you know, why Vietnam? What are we doing? And there wasn't, there really wasn't any esprit de corps among the draftees. The very few people who had joined the Army amongst us had usually joined with a nudge from the judge. A lot of people at that point, if you got in trouble with the law and you were draft age, if you were 19, 20 years old, instead of a sentence, they just put you in the Army. So people who were considered regular Army, they had joined, but not necessarily of their own free will. So between those kind of RAs, regular Army people, and us draftees, there was just, nobody wanted to go to Vietnam. You know, there was nobody who felt that we were threatened or felt that, there was any particular reason to go. What the driving force behind people continuing to follow blindly in the training was Leavenworth and peer pressure. So during our meetings there behind Fort Gordon, Georgia, people were wondering what we could do. You know, some people were pretending to be crazy to get out of the military. Some people would wet the bed. Some people would, they were doing all kind of things. People were doing things to avoid Vietnam. And some of us thought that we should do something as soldiers publicly to let people know how we feel. And there got to be a core group. There were six of us who met behind that building with the group who decided to do something publicly, and we started to explore those options. And so there would have been a Fort Hood 6 at one point. We would joke about that. There was a Fort Hood 6. Then one of the guys who was in the group thought he could work better in the Army. He thought he would go undercover, and he didn't want to go public, and he would help us he was just trying to get out of, going to jail or getting in trouble. But that was all right. Great guy. So then it was the Fort Hood 5, and then the fifth guy, he was able to pull strings. His father knew a senator, and he was able to pull strings and get assigned to a chaplain as a chaplain's assistant. So he was out of the picture. He was safe. So there was a lot of people like scurrying for safety to avoid being sent to Vietnam. Lots of scurrying around. Same on the outside, people going to school and doing things to avoid the draft. Then people inside were trying to find safety somewhere. So end up being four of us that decided we want to do something publicly and we're going to risk jail. And essentially, we were trying to alleviate the pressure, peer pressure. We were trying to let people know that you don't have to be afraid of other soldiers. You can march to the beat of your own drum. And we were trying to alleviate the fear of Leavenworth. So we were facing those two fears head on, and in the hopes that it would make it easier for people to emulate us or follow in our footsteps or do whatever they wanted to do to avoid the war with less fear of prison and less fear of peer pressure. So four of us at that point got to leave and went to New York City. Oh, no, before that had happened, three of us, J.J., Dennis, and myself, the Fort Hood 3. The three of us, when there was still a Fort Hood 4, we left the fourth guy at home because he was a libertarian. We thought we had a pretty nice blend. J.J. is black, Dennis is Puerto Rican, I'm white, and Joel was, Turtell was Jewish and a libertarian. So we were all like different, you know, from different backgrounds. At any rate, the three of us went to a peace group in Atlanta to make our first little public foray. And it was a very tiny, tiny group. We got the name from the college there. And we went to them. We showed up unannounced and said we were three soldiers, and we had intended that there were four of us, and that we were intending to refuse orders and do something publicly, but we didn't know what. And they didn't know what to do with us, but they sent us in the right direction. There was a SNCC conference in town that weekend, and so the three of us showed up at the conference.
And David, SNCC is the student, or the Southern, no, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Correct.
And
we hadn't had, Stokely Carmichael had been the head of it. I think at that point he was probably in Africa already, and it was before Rap Brown.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure who was heading it up. Anyway, we met some interesting people there. When we showed up in our uniforms, their security patrol, they were, you know, watching themselves, because it was a dangerous place for black people anyway, organizing politically in the South. So they had guys who were armed that met us when we tried to walk out. I forget, it was a college campus, the black college there, and the name eludes me. Anyway, they met us with guns, and when they found out that we were there to refuse the war, they were totally intrigued and delighted. And so they welcomed us in, and we spent the rest of the day in workshops talking about the war and talking about soldiers, how we feel about the war, and, you know, all the different issues that soldiers have. And they put us in touch with people in New York City. They gave us they wanted us to use Kunstler, I forget his first name.
William Kunstler.
William Kunstler, because he was the lawyer for SNCC at that point. But we were concerned because Kunstler was defending some French Canadian students who had attempted to blow up the Statue of Liberty and the Washington Monument, a few things that they were involved in, a romantic, you know, ill-fated thing. But we didn't want Kunstler representing us at that point, because we were trying to look like we were all American kids, and we weren't left-wing, right-wing, or anything.
Could you say a word about your two comrades? You called them JJ?
Yeah.
And
James Johnson and Dennis Mora.
And Dennis Mora. Could just fill us in a couple of words about them?
Well, we met while we were at Fort Gordon, Georgia. Dennis was the oldest. He's 25, and I was like 19 or something. Or maybe he was 23. There was a little bit of age difference. And he had had some political involvement with a group in New York City, the Du Bois Club. And he had at first refused induction when he showed up for his draft, and he had made some fuss. But then he basically was cowed into going along with everybody else, and he stepped forward and took the oath. And J.J., James Johnson, was a bank teller at that point in New York City. They both had college, you know, education a little bit. And, you know, we just kind of got to know each other. We were similar. We were all being trained to be telephone operators and installers, you know, in combat situations and stuff. We learned everything about telephonic communication. So...
So you went to New York, sorry.
Yeah, so anyway, we got some leave, and we went to New York, and SNCC had put us in touch with the War Resisters League. So we went to a meeting with the War Resisters League in New York City, which was headed up by A.J. Musty and David Dellinger, David Dellinger later was head of the mobilization against the war in Vietnam. And A.J. Musty was probably about 83, 84 at that point. And he had refused induction into World War I and had gone to prison back then. He had been in Leavenworth in World War I. And David Dellinger had done time in World War II. And anyway, Musty was a very impressive fella. Partly was his age, and partly was his youthful attitude. And, you know, he was a great guy. He was personal friends with Bertrand Russell, a philosopher of that period, well-respected man. And A.J. Musty was well-respected. And at any rate, he kind of put us in the hands of David Dellinger to help us get a defense committee set up. So what that meant was developing some flyers and getting people who would agree to be on the letterhead, basically, so we could use their names. And we had started getting support immediately from people that we had heard of. You know, our Noam Chomsky was on the support on our letterhead. Pete Seeger was there. Senator Gruning, a young congressman from Atlanta, black congressman who I forget. There were several congresspeople and Senate people. There was two senators, Gruning and another guy began with an F, his name. I can't remember his name.
David, let me interrupt you for a minute mm-hmm. here. I have to tell the listeners that this is KZYX. My name is Cal Winslow, and our program is talking about California. And today we're talking about a fellow citizen of Mendocino County here, of the coast, David Samus. And David is a veteran of a very famous group in the 1960s, the Fort Hood Three. Before we get back, I want to remind you that this is Fundrise Drive Week at KZYX, and we're going to have a brief interruption here while we talk about the fund drive, and then we'll be back and continue with David about the Fort Hood Three. Okay, so David, I'm sorry I interrupted you. You were talking about getting some support organized. I have to say, for listeners, they may not remember all of the names, but I found a pamphlet about you guys and the list of endorsers. As you were saying, it was the all-star list of the anti-war movement of the 1960s that was organizing in your behalf. You mentioned the political figures, civil rights figures. I said at the beginning of the program that Pete Seeger wrote a song about you guys. It was called The Ballad of the Fort Hood Three. One line in it is, "Next, Private David Samus, a Californian, his background Lithuanian, also Italian. The policeman told his father something quite absurd. They'd arrange for him a discharge if he'd just retract these words." Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. We were constantly... The whole time I was in jail, I was approached or taken places when deals were made for if I would recapitulate, if I would turn on J.J. and Dennis, if I would say that I was in the pay of the communists, if I would say all sorts of things. I was promised duty in different places, discharges. I was promised all kinds of things if I would take back my word. But we were treated miserably in prison in that regard.
Well, what happened? I see that you sued the Secretary of War, McNamara.
Yes, that's what we, okay, after we were, we set up a defense committee, then we got a lawyer. And I think it was, again, I'm pretty sure it was Dellinger who put us in touch with Stanley Faulkner. And we still didn't quite know what we were going to do. And Stanley had prepared already on his own, was preparing a suit to stop sending draftees to an undeclared war. And it was an elaborate suit. It stated that America was in violation of 11 different international treaties and... Anyway, it was very professionally well done, and we signed on to it. He would defend us in any case that came up with the military, but first of all, we would sign on and file suit against the government. We sued McNamara and Secretary Ball and a whole list of people. We filed a suit in the federal court, and we decided that when we announced the filing of that suit, we would also announce our intentions to disobey orders for Vietnam, were we to get orders. At this point, we didn't have orders for Vietnam. We started the suit, and we had yet to receive orders. But at this point, there were still four of us, the Fort Hood Four, and we went back to our service after our short thing in New York, and where we had met several people. We had done a interview, the four of us, in the Guardian, National Guardian, and done a couple other things to begin raising funds. But by the time we got back to the base, our fourth partner had turned on us, and information was now leaked out to officers, people. I was starting to get threatened from, I was called into the company commander and threatened with 15 years in prison if I continue causing disaffection. That's what they were calling it. So I just said, this is none of their business. I do what I want to do. At any rate, he dropped out. The three of us continued in our endeavors, and the suit was prepared. And the next time we got leave, we went to New York City, and we had a press conference and filed the suit in Washington, D.C. We got a lawyer in Washington, D.C., a lady named Samuels. I forget her first name. And so she filed the actual suit in Washington, and Stanley was in New York. And then we had the press conference. Three of us became then the Fort Hood Three. And we would often make jokes about, well, maybe there's a Fort Hood Two, maybe it's going to be a Fort Hood One. But at that point, it was solid. Our relationship was rock solid. We had each other's backs. We had deep respect for each other. We knew each other's families by this point. We were unshakable. As far as that's concerned, we were unshakable. So we had a press conference. We announced that we would refuse orders. I think by this time, I'm not sure the chronology of things, that was 45 years ago, but I think we may have had written orders at this point. Our lawyer, Stanley, was trying to help us avoid committing a mutiny, because mutiny is life imprisonment, 15 to life, and it could be that's quite serious. And so everything we did, we were always certain and sure of our word, so that we wouldn't say we refuse. It was I refuse. And so as three individuals, we did everything as individuals rather than as a group, even though we were skirting the issue of mutiny. We were accused of being mutiny by, later on down the line. But anyway, we were trying to be safe. So refusing a written order is punishable by the maximum of 3 years in Leavenworth. Refusing a direct order is punishable by 5 years. So the Army issued a state, the Pentagon issued a press release after our press conference, saying that we were within our rights to do what we were doing. And we had freedom, we had all the freedoms of anybody on the outside, and we could say whatever we wanted. And we later, years later, got copies of the TWIXT between, this is before emails and stuff. TWIXT is a teletype communication between armies. America has eight armies, and any communication between one army and the next has to be done through TWIXT. So years later, we got the copies of the TWIXT between the armies that were concerned with how to handle the Fort Hood 3, how to suppression of the Fort Hood 3. And the first on the list was to make us, to manipulate us into refusing a direct verbal order so that we could get our maximum sentence. So basically, the press release from the Pentagon was like trying to give us enough rope to hang ourselves. And we kind of did that. We kept talking. And then eventually I was arrested. We were all three arrested in New York City while we were on leave before going to Vietnam. We had gotten our orders. We had 30 days of leave before you show up at Oakland to get on a boat or something. I forget.
Yeah, the Oakland Army Terminal you were headed. I have a note here, July 13th, you were supposed to turn up.
Yeah. So we got arrested like the week before that or something. We were arrested by the New York City police, and then the Army came and took us. Of course, they were all there. There was maybe about 20 people who showed up to arrest me in the street. And I had been followed before that. As soon as we had the press conference, the next day, I was staying in Hunts Point in New York. The next day, three people started following me everywhere. When I left the house, there were three guys following me everywhere I went. And then they started following all of our families. My father was approached. My brother, who was a prison guard in California, was approached. Men in black suits told them they couldn't say anything in my support, warned them that their jobs were in jeopardy if they offered any kind of comfort or aid to me. And all of our families were threatened one way or another, or just intimidated by having people follow them. It was quite eye-opening. At any rate, we were arrested for sedition, and then that's what the charges they read, citing disaffection and sedition, and I was facing a 15-year sentence for that. But I'm not sure what the deal was, but almost immediately, we were just held. I was held in a cage for maybe 6 or 7 hours. And then they came and rescinded that arrest and said I wasn't under arrest, that my orders had simply been changed. And at that point, they took me to an abandoned building. And I was in Fort Dix Stockade. And they took me to an abandoned building. And then I saw J.J. in another car and Dennis in another car. And there must have been 30 or 40 personnel guarding us. And they brought all three of us. We had been arrested separately in New York, and then this was the first that we'd seen each other. It was here. The cars pulled up in the middle of the night outside this abandoned building, and they started to unload us. And then the officer who was at the building already lost his temper and started screaming. We weren't supposed to be there because they were busy putting in microphones under the building. And when we got there, there was people crawling around under the building, wiring the microphones. And, that was an error. So people stood, they ordered the soldiers to stand in front of the car so I couldn't see what they were doing. But it was obvious. I could, peek around people and stuff, and I could see the guys working under the building, installing speakers. And so they held us in this, it was an abandoned office building. They put the fourth guy who had turned on us already, they put the four of us together in a room, and we each had a guard watching us personally 24 hours a day. So there was four of us in the room and four guards. And I had a guard assigned to me 24 hours a day to take a shower or take a crap or go to bed, do whatever I did. Someone stood and looked at me. And we were kept that way for 3 weeks. Supposedly, we weren't under arrest, but we weren't allowed to talk to anybody or have visitors. We could see our lawyer. We could have a few things. We could have newspapers. And a few things we were allowed. But essentially, we were in prison. And then in the middle of the night, one night, they took me away and put me in another place, another abandoned building on the base. And they did the same thing to J.J. and to Dennis. They separated us again and held us for 3 or 4 days like that. I was in a small room, must have been a closet or something, it was about the size of a prison cell, and a guard stood in the door, like not more than 5 feet from me, and watched me 24 hours a day. So that was so they were intimidating us pretty good. Then all of a sudden, in the middle of one night, an officer showed up, had clothes for me, had my dress uniform, handed it to me, said, "Get dressed. We're going to the airport." And then he handed me orders for Vietnam, a new set of orders, that I was to board a plane immediately and go to Vietnam. So this is at Fort Dix. I guess I don't know where the heck the airport was. But anyway, they took me to the airport. I got dressed. They took me to the airport. And in the car on the way, an officer sat next to me, and there was two guards in the front seat. And I gave the officer my orders. They were all in abbreviations. I didn't quite understand. I said, would you read this for me? What exactly does it say? And then he read it to me. And then I said, here, you can have it. These orders aren't any good for me. I'm not going to follow this bullshit anyway. And he wouldn't take the orders. I handed him the orders, and he wouldn't take them. And I just the paper just fell on the floor between us because he didn't want to touch the orders, and I didn't want them. And he was trying to avoid me. If I disobeyed written orders, 3 years. And they were trying to get me to do the five-year deal. So anyway, the car pulled up at the back of an airplane somewhere on a base somewhere, and they had the tail of the airplane, the door and the tail open, which they don't usually load you that way. And they was on a tarmac, and there was a whole entourage of officers with, you know, colonels and generals and all high-ranking officers. And the car pulled up in front of them, and the officer who was supposed to read me the orders, I refused to get out of the car. And he stuck his head in the window, and his hat fell off. And then he was all embarrassed and flustered, and he lost his temper. And he said, at least the son of a bitch can come out of the car and talk to us. So I said, okay, I'll get out of the car, but I'm not going to Vietnam. So I stood there at attention, and he read the order to me. And so this is a direct order from some major, who I don't know what the hell his name was. He had a corncob pipe like MacArthur. Real affected. Anyway, he read the order to me. I refused it. He read it again. I refused it. He read it a third time. I refused it. And there they had me. Now that's 5 years. And so they immediately handcuffed me, threw me in the back of the car, and took me off to the Fort Dix stockade. And there was no reception or anything like that. They immediately took me out of the car, manhandled me, strip searched me, pushed me around a bunch, and, you know, called me names and gave them a little bit of free, you know, free shots at me as far as that's concerned. And then dragged me off in right directly into the maximum security area of the Fort Dix stockade. And the maximum security, there was two little buildings surrounded by razor wire with the no man's land in between and guard towers and everything. And they took the buildings. There was only 14 cells in each building, so there was 28 seg cells of segregation. And they had to take me through one building to get me into the next building where my cell was. And so my first exposure to prison, I was being hustled past these other cells. There were seven other cells. And then the first cell was Dennis already. He was already in the cell. And he said, you know, stay strong, Samus. And then other people, I started hearing prisoners shouting, the other guy is here. And then people started shouting, I mean, we can't use the F word, correct? But FTA, which was, you know, frig the army or whatever word I can say, FTA. But everybody started shouting.
Well, the second two, the first two, first word we can't say. The second two words are the army, right?
Yeah, the second
and
two words are the army.
David, we're going to have to speed up a little bit here because I want the listeners to hear a bit about what happens right after this. So a little faster through time. It's where we're a little constrained today because of the pledge drive. But so if you, what happens here, and then how do you get to Leavenworth?
Well, okay, we're in Fort Dix for the court-martial. And the first court-martial came. Dennis was the first one to get court-martialed, and he only got 3 years. And they were flabbergasted. The army was that he didn't get the maximum sentence. And his trial took 3 days. And my trial came where it took. No, then JJ's trial took a day and a half. He got 5 years. Then my trial came. It took about 3 hours. And the judge said, to our lawyer, if you're going to introduce the same things, if you're going to say any of the same things you said in the first two cases, forget it. I'm going to overrule you right now, so you have nothing to say. And so my lawyer had nothing to say. He wasn't allowed to say anything. So my trial consisted of just me taking the stand for a few minutes and then them finding me guilty. So then we were from Fort Dix Stockade. There were demonstrations outside the stockade, and people were getting arrested. In fact, A.J. Musley got arrested. He was like 83, and they handcuffed him, threw him in the back of a paddy wagon because he tried to bring us books, and the stockade didn't have anything. Military prison is kind of sparse. The cells are metal. You have metal walls, metal floor, metal ceiling, bars, metal bunk, nothing inside the cell. That's it. And you sit there. So it wears on you, you know. It really does wear on you. So at any rate, all of a sudden, like 3 months later, boom, in the middle of the night, someone came, gave me a uniform, said, here you go, you're going somewhere different. I didn't know where I was going. And then at the airport, there's JJ and there's Dennis again. They put us on a plane, and we were going to Fort Meade, Maryland, because they were concerned about the demonstrations at Fort Dix. And so all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, they moved us to Maryland. We were there for 3 months and waiting to get to Leavenworth. And then after 3 months, in solitary confinement, we got to Leavenworth, which was a great relief to finally get to prison.
Well, we've got a couple minutes left. Now, going to prison, man, Leavenworth, it's pretty terrifying today.
Oh, yeah.
For people to think about it. How did you manage that, and what happened in a couple of minutes?
Well, you know, by the time I got to Leavenworth, I had already gone through, sort of a spiritual experience. In the Fort Meade stockade, my cell, you know, the cell is really small. It's 6x8. And I wasn't allowed to come within 18 inches of the bars in my cell. And I couldn't touch any of the walls in my cell. I couldn't lean against any of the walls. And so 24 hours a day, I had to just sit there. Like, I couldn't sit on the bunk either. It's a metal bunk. I could sit on the toilet, or I could sit on the floor and polish my shoes. And so that's what I did. And I realized at that point, at a certain point there, I was so miserable, but I was so inspired still by other people who had gone through this kind of things, you know, in so many different places in the world and in history. And I realized I'm suffering. Then I realized this is what suffering is. And it was like a revelation. Well, I could just let go of it. Once I realized I was suffering and what suffering was, I took the next breath. I'm breathing. I'm not bleeding. I'm not suffering. I'm only suffering when I let my mind tell me I'm suffering. So anyway, that was, you know, I had that on my side by the time I got to Leavenworth. When we got to Leavenworth, three of us were in. They had put us together finally in the back of a paddy wagon, two guards in the front. They drove us again. We didn't go through the regular reception. They drove us on to into the back of the prison itself, the castle. And it's very imposing. Leavenworth was built out of hand-hewn stone that they started building in the Civil War. They put people in holes in the ground in the Civil War, kept them in there, fed them 2 pounds of potatoes a day, that's what they got, and they worked in the quarry making these walls. Huge walls, very impressive, 50-foot-high walls of hand-hewn stone, and what they called inside of the walls, the main prison was called the castle. It had 8 wings like an octopus and off of a rotunda that soared maybe 125 feet in the air. Beautiful, impressive, except it was all painted dark brown on the inside. And very, very controlled. But Leavenworth, you could have music, you can have some M&Ms, you could have cigarettes, you could have books. And after 6 months without hearing music, being in the hole like that, 6 months without, you know, reading a book, I would get, occasionally I would get they would let me have a paper. I was supposed to get, I had a subscription to the New York Times, but they would only give me a paper every once in a while. And the stockades treated you miserably. They give you mail every once in a while. We only got to have three. We could write to three people, hear from three people. That continued on all on through Leavenworth, too.
So how long were you there, David? We're running out of time, so...
Okay, Leavenworth was like... I was in Leavenworth 2 years. I was in prison almost 3 years total. My five-year sentence was finally reduced in the appeals court to 3 years because I essentially didn't even have a trial. And so they reduced all three of us to have the same sentence. They ruled that we should all have been allowed to present our cases. And so we got whatever the first guy got, they gave it us too. So, and our case made it, while we were in Leavenworth, our case kept proceeding. It finally made it to the Supreme Court, but it missed being heard by one vote.
Listen, David, I've got to cut you off. This has really been very interesting, and I'm very, very sorry that we can't go on and talk more about it. But thanks and good luck, and maybe we'll find a way to get back into this story, because I know there's an awful lot that we haven't had a chance to hear. I would mention to, listeners, these guys were heroes. These guys were known all over the world. They were amongst the very first of the American GIs who built a movement which is about as much as anything helped to end the war in Vietnam. I would recommend, if you haven't seen it, a new film, I think it's new, called Sir No Sir. You can watch that. That takes the story beginning with David, our neighbor here on the Mendocino Coast, and his comrades in the Fort Hood 3, begins with them and takes the story into the 1970s and the beginning of the end of the war. So, David, thanks. Many thanks again. And good luck to you and to your mushroom farming. And let me say that this is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. I'll be back again next week at Thursday at 9. Don't forget about the pledge drive. Good morning.
Thanks, Cal.
Just leaving. That was really good. I'm sorry we didn't have more time. You did a great job. It's a wonderful story, and I do think I'm going to write to Robin about it, and Robin Spencer, and it's something that really has to, we has a story we have to remember and get around more. So I appreciate it, David.
Yep. Great, Cal. Thank you.
Let you go. Back to work.
Okie doke. Bye. Back to work.